contentment that dominated his current life, David became highly motivated. It was terribly distasteful for him to think he was giving his power away. The thought of that man controlling him from the grave was sickening to David. He wanted his power back. He wanted it for himself and his family. What ultimately turned the corner for David was that he came to understand that you don't have to have the other person's cooperation in order to forgive them. That other person doesn't even have to know. They do not have to be sorry. They do not have to admit the error of their ways. Forgiveness is about you, not them. It also helped David to learn that in self-management, sometimes we have to give ourselves what we wish we could get from others. David's father could not tell him that he loved him. He could not tell him that he was, in fact, a good man worthy of good things in life. He couldn't tell him because he was dead. David could wait however long he wanted. He could pout and rage for years, but it would do no good. I convinced David that he had to give himself that which he wished he could get from his father. He had to be willing to look at himself in the mirror and say the things to himself that he wished he could have heard from his father. He literally had to say, "David, you are a good man. You have always been good. You are entitled to the feelings and rewards of a healthy and balanced life, and you shall have them because you deserve them. Because your father did not choose to see these qualities does not mean that they are not there. He did not see them because of his filter, not because of your deficiencies." When David could honestly look himself in the mirror and give himself that which he wished he would have had from his father, he found the strength and courage to forgive his father. He knew if he was truly a man, he would have to rise above his raising. He knew how tortuous it was to feel the way he had felt, and he was able to appreciate that that may well have been the same tortured existence that his father lived throughout his life. He forgave his father for himself and for his young son and wife. He forgave his father because he did not want to live in his image and suffer the pain and hurt that had been so much a part of that relationship. Once David gave all of this to himself and then forgave his father, he was free to choose his own way of being in the world. He decided that he would not be a prisoner of that parental legacy. In one of our last sessions, he looked me in the eye and said, "This cannot go on. It has to stop here. It has to stop now, or my son will pay the same price I had to pay." By having that insight and following it with the actions I have described, David was able to break the bond and have the freedom that only forgiveness can bring. I challenge you to identify these same feelings in your life. I challenge you to identify and list in your journal those people who have you locked in this bond of hatred, anger, and resentment. I challenge you to care enough about yourself and those you love to break that bond and be free of the tortured existence that comes from harboring those terrible emotions. By taking this approach and rethinking the meaning of forgiveness, you can and will set yourself free from the pain that has been caused by others in your life. Otherwise, your hatred, anger, and resentment will be so consuming that they become part of every waking hour you have. They will make you cynical. They will make you suspicious. They will cause you to put walls up around yourself and exact a toll from those who have done nothing but love you. If you allow people who have transgressed against you to lock you into that role, they win. The power of forgiveness is the power to set yourself free from the bonds of hatred, anger, and resentment. Seize the power and rise above the pain. You are worth it, and everyone you love deserves it. Life law number 10. You have to name it to claim it. Your strategy: get clear on what you want and take your turn. Common sense might suggest that one of the easiest steps in getting what you want from life is to place your order, to stand up and declare what it is that you desire. Nothing could be further from the truth. I'm convinced that if the mythical genie ever did pop out of the bottle and say, "Tell me your wish," most people would stutter, stammer, and be in terrible conflict about what to ask for. Not knowing precisely what you want is not okay. This life law means what it says in the most basic sense. If you cannot name what it is that you want, then you will never be able to step up and claim it. The purpose of this discussion is to impress upon you the need for focusing on what you want and teaching you how to describe it and name it so that you can recognize it and claim it. If you've been folding the other 9 life laws into your thinking, in other words, amassing the knowledge necessary to start having what you want, learning about this life law should be exciting and fun. Think about those times in your life when you have been brought to a standstill by a simple choice. If you can't decide which movie to see, what to order in a restaurant, or what to wear, is it any wonder you find it hard to identify goals? Indecision creates inaction. Inaction leads to results that you do not want. This makes your journey through life like that of an unguided missile, an approach that simply will not work. There's a harsh truth to take into account here. Since naming what you truly want is so basic to having it, you must proceed with great care in deciding the answer. Being wrong or misguided about what you want is even worse than not knowing at all. I can't tell you how many times I have encountered people professionally, and personally for that matter, who spent years or a lifetime working towards something they were certain was what they wanted. They worked hard, they worked long, and they made sacrifices. Nothing was sadder than seeing them ultimately reach their goal, only to be disappointed by the arrival. They hadn't just been inert, they had gone down the wrong road, diligently moving in the wrong direction, and now were far, far from home. You must also pay attention to the time element associated with what you want. Opportunities for getting what you want are time limited. They have a shelf life that can and will expire. For example, suppose that you decide that what you really want is to have a meaningful and intimate relationship with your children. You want to have the opportunity to know them and influence them as they develop and define themselves as people. But now suppose that you decide this long after that window of opportunity has passed. Maybe they have filled that role with other people, or moved on to a point where they are no longer interested or receptive to your playing this role in their lives. Discovering that you had missed your chance would be heartbreaking. That's why I suggest you bring an element of urgency to your thinking and planning about what you want. I'm not suggesting that you panic. I'm not suggesting that you behave imprudently in the pursuit of some poorly thought-out goal. But you should move with specificity and project status urgency toward naming and claiming what you want. The need for specificity applies to every goal you will ever set. You need to know so much about what you want that whenever you're heading toward it, you know it, you feel it, and you sense it. Similarly, when you are off track, you need to know, feel, and sense that as well. When you know your goals, you will recognize which types of behavior and choices support them and which do not. When you know a goal intimately, you'll feel it when you get close, and at the right time, you'll jump on it like a duck on a June bug, but only if you know it when you see it. When I say that you must have intimate knowledge of what you want, I mean that you must be able to describe it with a variety of terms and from different points of view. If you want to succeed, you have to be able to answer the following questions. What is success for you? In other words, where is the goal line? What specifically do you have to create in your life in order for you to say, bingo, that's it? What aspects of your life do you have to overcome or change in order to get it? In other words, what are you doing or not doing right now that will impede your efforts to get what you want? If you can't answer all of those questions in great detail, you are not ready. One of the most common mistakes people make in declaring what they want is to be too general or too abstract. How often, for example, have you said or heard someone else say, "All I really want in this life is to be happy"? It sounds like a common sense answer, but as a life goal, it is destined for failure. My dog Barkley wants to be happy. Does that mean that the two of you want the same thing? I don't think so. I'll bet everything I own that you and Barkley define happiness very differently. So unless you're willing to settle for someone scratching your belly and letting you sleep under the coffee table, you might want to be a little more precise about what you as a unique individual really want. The following suggestions may help you get started on properly identifying and naming what you truly want. First, be bold yet realistic. Don't be shy about admitting that you want some special things, some special feelings and experiences. As I've said, the most you'll ever get is what you ask for. Don't aim too low, because if you do, you could spend the rest of your life working for what you don't want. On the other hand, do be realistic. Take stock of who you are and where you are. A favorite observation about the United States is that here anybody can grow up to be president. That may be true, but you probably need to have started taking preparatory steps long before you wake up at 50 years old with no political experience, no formal education, and a background in yard work. If what you want is to play in the NBA, and you're 45 years old with a vertical leap of about 2 inches, the chances are pretty good you need to want something else. So as you prepare to name what you want, be bold enough to reach for what will truly fill you up without being unrealistic. If that sounds a little disheartening, just stand by. Because I'll bet you don't have to be president to get what you really want anyway, as we will soon see. Secondly, be careful not to confuse the means with the end. Almost invariably, people will focus on an object or an event without following through to the next important step, which is identifying how that object or event would make them feel. For example, your first attempt to name what you want might be, "I want a fancy car and a high-paying job." I would suggest to you that the fancy car and the high-paying job are simply a means to an end, rather than being the end in themselves. You need to go further. You must be willing to ask yourself, "Why do I want a fancy car and a high-paying job?" The answer is very likely that you want them because of how you think you will feel when you have them. In this example, the car and the job probably represent for you a sense of security and quality in your life, things to which you respond very strongly. Your true goal, then, is not the car or the high-paying job, but the specific feeling that you associate with having those things. Cars get old, get beat up and rusty. High-paying jobs can go away through layoffs or getting fired. If you really think it's a car you want, then just go to the junkyard and find the make and model you would have died for 5 or 10 years ago. If such a thing truly is your goal, I suggest you need to rethink it. Put another way, if what you really want is to feel proud of yourself and secure in your life, it would be unfair to restrict yourself to getting just a car and a job. Maybe there are 10 different ways for you to arrive at the same desired destination, and any one of those 10 could work for you. Your chances of getting what you want when you have 10 different avenues of pursuit are clearly greater than when you've limited yourself to just one or two. And it may turn out that when you determine why you want the car and job, you decide those two things wouldn't do the trick anyway. You then avoid wasting precious time and energy working for something you didn't really want to begin with. What you want can probably be described in a number of ways, and you need to be as specific as possible in describing each and every one. Your want can be described in terms of how it will look to people other than yourself, how it will make you feel inside, the kinds of reactions and feelings it would generate in other people, and what behavior it involves. By being specific and defining your goal in as many different ways as you can, you'll develop a more intimate understanding of what you want. As a result, the choices you make along the way will be more goal-directed. You'll also be more likely to recognize your goal when you get there, since you'll have so many criteria by which to measure it. Now, for the second part of Life Law 10, claim it. This half of the law can present as big a challenge and be just as difficult a task as naming what you want. Claiming it takes resolve and commitment. You've heard the joke, "The meek may inherit the earth, but none of them will step up and claim the deed." You must be willing to require yourself to step up when the time is right and claim what you want and deserve. You must be willing to step up and say, "Stop the world. It's my time, it's my turn, and I claim this for me." Understand, this is a competitive world in which we live. As I've said before, there are a lot of dogs after them bones. Nothing could be more true. There are a lot of people who are ready, willing, and able to take from you that which is rightfully yours. It might be your property. It might be your space. It might be your very right to think, feel, and believe in a certain way. Why would you want to make it easier for them? Why leave the windows open for thieves? Once you have strength and resolve enough to believe that you deserve what it is that you want, then and only then will you be bold enough to say, "It's my time, it's my turn, this is for me, and I claim it right here, right now." Having the willingness and courage to claim what you want is a major element in successfully applying this life law. It may be an especially important issue to you, since it may very well be out of character for you. If you have spent most of your life settling for what you don't want, or settling too cheaply, then enforcing a standard of excellence and non-compromise will feel like an unnatural act. That means that taking this step from mediocrity to quality in your life will require conscious resolve. You must, in effect, sit down with yourself and have a conversation that leads to a serious life decision. As I said earlier, managers have to produce results in a competitive world. You must require of yourself what you would require of someone you would hire as a life manager. Assuming I took the job as your life manager, I wonder how long I would remain employed if, in our quest for attaining what you want in your life, I began to waver in my conviction about your right to have it. I wonder how long I would stay employed as your life manager if I came to you and said, "Hey, I've been thinking about your list of life goals, and I'm not really so sure that you deserve what you want. I mean, think about it. You're really nothing special. These are the kinds of things that other people get. Not everybody can have what he or she wants. You just need to calm down and be happy that your life isn't worse than it is." Now, if I said that to you, you would probably fire me, and the problem would be solved. But you can't fire you. That means the solution is not so easy. Be the most effective life manager you can imagine. Make the resolve now that your wants are worth having and that when the time comes, you will claim your right to have them. By internalizing Life Law 10, we learn to define what we want and then claim it. But remember, the watchword all along has been, be realistic. You can't claim ill-defined dreams. You must set your sights on concrete goals. That's what I'd like to talk about right now. 7 steps to acquiring the goals you set. Step number 1. Express your goal in terms of specific events or behaviors. In order for a goal to be attainable, it must be operationally defined. In other words, it must be expressed in terms of the events or behaviors that constitute the goal. For example, in the language of dreams, the desire to travel might be expressed simply as, I want to see the world. By contrast, in the language of goals and realities, it would be necessary to express this desire by describing the operations or behaviors that define what is meant by see the world. A goal statement might be, I intend to travel to 3 different states and 1 foreign country each year for 5 years. Now that the desire has been broken down into steps, it can be managed and pursued much more directly than can the ambiguous blue sky dream. Step number 2. Express your goal in terms that can be measured. Unlike dreams, goals must be expressed in terms of outcomes that are measurable, observable, and quantifiable. In order for something to rise to the level of a manageable goal, you've got to be able to determine your level of progress. You need to know how much of the goal you've attained. You have to have some way of knowing whether you have, in fact, successfully arrived at where you wanted to be. In the dream world, you might say, I want a wonderful and rewarding life. In the world of goals and realities, you would define wonderful and rewarding with the same kind of specificity we stated in step number 1, but also in terms that are measurable. That is, you would express them in such a way that you could determine how much wonderful you have and how rewarding it is. Relevant questions might be, in order for your life to be wonderful, where would you live? In order for it to be wonderful, who would you spend your life with? How much money would you have? In what type of work or activities would you be involved? Any number of other details might serve as examples of measurable outcomes, but I trust that you get the point. Step number 3. Assign a timeline to your goal. In a dream world, you might say, I want to be rich someday. But a statement in the world of goals and realities would sound more like, I want to have achieved an income of $100,000 per year by December 31 in the year 2000. By making a schedule or timeline, you impose project status on the goal. The deadline you've created fosters a sense of urgency or purpose, which in turn will serve as an important motivator. Goals involve time-sensitive requirements that do not allow for inertia or procrastination. Once you have determined precisely what it is you want, you must decide on a time frame for having it. Step number 4. Choose a goal you can control. A dream world statement might be, my dream is to have a beautiful white Christmas. But here's a more realistic statement. I am going to create a nostalgic and traditional atmosphere for our family at Christmas time. Obviously, since you cannot control the weather, snowfall is not an appropriate goal. On the other hand, you can control such things as the decorations, the music, and the food you offer during the holidays. It's appropriate to make those circumstances part of your goal because you can control them. Step number 5, plan and program a strategy that will get you to your goal. To pursue a goal seriously requires that you realistically assess the obstacles and resources involved and that you create a strategy for navigating that reality. One of the great benefits of having a well-planned, well-programmed strategy is that it liberates you from a pointless and misguided reliance on willpower. The very notion that you've got to have willpower is a myth. Willpower is an unreliable emotional fuel. Experienced at a fever pitch, it may temporarily energize your efforts. Once the emotion is gone, however, the train stops. You've had enough false starts in your life to know that there are times when you do not feel motivated, when you do not feel energized. The only way to guarantee forward movement during those downtimes is to design a solid strategic plan that sustains your commitment in the absence of emotional energy. Specifically, your environment must be programmed, your schedule must be programmed, and your accountability must be programmed in such a way that all three support you long after the emotional high is gone. Suppose you want to read and study a 500-page book in a 30-day period. Notice, first of all, what makes this a workable goal. It's specific, it's measurable, and it has a timeline. Determining how many pages you need to read per day would be a simple arithmetic problem. The real challenge would be to make a plan that would program you and your world for literally getting those pages read. This would require identifying how much time per day you would need to read the specific number of pages. Identifying the specific time each day when the reading would take place. And identifying the physical location where you could read without interruption or distraction and where you could be sure you would be present at the appointed time in your busy day. The significance of programming is that it recognizes that your life is full of temptations and opportunities to fail. Those temptations and opportunities compete with your more constructive and task-oriented behavior. Without programming, you will find it much harder to stay the course. Step 6. Define your goal in terms of steps. Unlike dreams, whose outcomes we pretend will just happen one day, goals are carefully broken down into measurable steps that lead, ultimately, to the desired outcome. A dream world statement might be, "Someday, I'm going to lose all of this weight." A reality-based statement would instead be, "I will take certain steps to lose 3 pounds per week for the next 20 weeks. At the end of that time, I will be wearing a size 8. Major life changes don't just happen. They happen one step at a time. When someone is considering it in its entirety, the dream of losing 60 pounds and 10 dress sizes can be so overwhelming as to be paralyzing. But it begins to look like a decidedly manageable goal when broken down into small steps of losing a few pounds per week. Step number 7. Create accountability for your progress towards your goal. Unlike dreams, which can be entertained at will, goals are structured in such a way that you have some measure of accountability at each and every interval step. In the dream world, you might decide that your child should have all B's on his or her report card by the end of the 6-week grading period. In the world of goals and realities, that same child would have step-by-step accountability, perhaps reporting to you or a teacher every Friday afternoon to review his or her results on all homework, quizzes, and tests. Faced with this interim accountability, the child is now motivated to perform and adjust since he or she now expects to be scrutinized on a weekly basis. Without accountability, people are apt to con themselves, failing to recognize poor performance in time to adjust and keep from falling short. So consider who, in your circle of family or friends, might serve as your teammate, the person to whom you commit to make periodic reports on your progress. We all respond better if we know that somebody is checking up on us and that there are consequences for our failure to perform. As you look back on where we've been in this program, you should realize that three important events have come to pass. You have met yourself in an intimate, blinders-off fashion for perhaps the first time in your life. You have learned the real-deal ways of the world in the 10 life laws that govern your outcomes. And you have acquired critical information about how to set and attain goals, the essence of your life strategy. Unless I have fallen way out of touch with how people feel when they are taking strategic control of their lives, I predict that you are feeling two parallel emotions right now. On the one hand, you are probably feeling some real anxiety and perhaps even an element of dread. That's okay. It is understandable because if you have truly learned the life laws, then the foundation and logic of your life may have been shaken to the core. You are probably questioning, or at least examining virtually every aspect of your existence at this point, and you may feel a great sense of urgency to quit wasting time. You may be angry at yourself for past decisions and actions or inactions. But you should also feel a great sense of excitement. As I said earlier, this is your best shot for taking your life to the next level. This is your chance to put your life together by design and do and be what you want to do and be. You're now equipped to make a life strategy that allows you to begin changing your life, one step, one goal, one priority at a time. Using the tools that you have learned, you can begin with your top priority and design a knowledge-based, results-based strategy for change, and take the definitive actions to live it. But remember that every individual has his or her own personality, attitude, and way of being present day to day. Every individual has his or her own personal best way of being. Every person has their own personal best persona for generating results. Your task is to discover and define your formula for getting the most out of life. It will be a formula unique to you, unlike anyone else's, and that's okay. It certainly doesn't have to be commonsensical or mainstream conformist. If it works for you, based on results, then that's the test. So what is your unique formula for success? Do you do your best when you're self-assured and maybe even a little bit cocky? Or are you at your best when you're quiet but determined? Is high energy your deal? Or is yours a more methodical, persistent style? Are you best when you take charge? Or are you a stronger supporter? Is a positive, receptive attitude your best mode? Or do you need to maintain a healthy skepticism? Are you a loner or a team player? Whatever it is, find your unique formula and live it with pride. It's often been said that we must learn from our mistakes. That is a true and wise statement. If you approach a situation in a certain manner and make a mistake, you need to take specific note of those unsuccessful attitudes and behaviors and cross them off your list of options. It never ceases to amaze me that people will continue to persist in attitudes or behaviors that simply do not work. What in the world are they thinking? What kind of life strategy is that? It's a life strategy for losers. It is a life strategy of someone who is so rigidly locked in on being right that they would rather lose than learn. They would rather beat their heads against the wall and blame the world for the outcome than admit that their approaches and behaviors are wrong. Although the admonition to learn from your mistakes is sound, it is only half of the story. You should also resolve to learn from your successes. Study, dissect, and analyze your successes with the same vigor and commitment with which you study, dissect, and analyze your mistakes. The downside of studying mistakes is that you spend a lot of time focusing on the negatives in your life. The upside of studying your successes is that you are focusing on positives. You are acknowledging that there are things in your life that are going right, and when you study them, you will find that they went right because you made them go right. And let me tell you something. I don't believe in luck, and I don't believe in randomness in life. I believe that what works in your life works because you make it work. I believe that things work in your life because you choose the right attitude and behavior to generate the right results. Study your successes in one area of your life, and you can increase the likelihood of repeating them elsewhere. If, for example, you have a relationship that is working particularly well, it is worth your time to sit down and figure out why. I am not suggesting that you analyze something to death rather than enjoy it, but it is useful if you can figure out what it is about the relationship that is rewarding to you. Do you approach it differently from those relationships that do not work? And if so, how? Do you behave differently? Have you placed this relationship at a priority level that calls for you to invest more energy in it than your other less successful relationships? Do you get certain feedback and responses in this relationship that are inspiring to you? Responses that you don't get from other relationships? What is it about you and this relationship that makes it special? What is it about this relationship that makes it among those things in your life that work and work well? In addition to studying your own successes, it can also be highly beneficial for you to emulate the successes and winning strategies of others. There is nothing wrong with identifying traits and characteristics of people that you admire and then folding those traits or characteristics into your own personality and life strategy. I'm not suggesting you try to be someone you are not. There's nothing wrong with who you are. What I am suggesting is that if there are people you know or have the opportunity to observe who are generating great results, applying strategies and characteristics that you admire, studying those people and using them as role models is a worthwhile endeavor. You may not admire everything about them, but you can choose to emulate those things that stand out positively. Having spent my life studying success, I can give you a head start on what you will find by studying winners. Over the years that I have studied success stories and the people who star in them, I have found that success is not a random phenomenon. If someone is a winner in business, for example, they have certain characteristics in common with those who are champions in sports or stars in the arts. People who are consistently winners are not lucky. They make their breaks. They do things that cause the world to stand up and take notice, and thus grant them rewards. They may each have a different goal and specific strategy, but if you laid all of their strategies and maps for success side by side, you would see that there is an invariable common core among those strategies. These common characteristics can be the all-important spice to your strategic soup. Pay close attention, for learning and incorporating this information can make the difference. Here are the top 10 elements consistently present in the successful people I have studied. Number 1, vision. People who consistently win get what they want because they know what they want. They see it, feel it, and experience it in their minds and hearts. They envision what they want and where they are going so clearly that they can project themselves forward to that moment of victory and describe it to you as though it were happening. Most people are afraid to let themselves get excited about having what they want because they fear they will jinx themselves or be disappointed if they don't get it. People who are consistently winners are undaunted by that fear. They take the risk of getting excited and can describe their moment of victory to you in vivid and palpable detail. They know what it will look and feel like and how it will change their lives. They have a vision that becomes their North Star. It keeps them motivated and efficiently on track. Number two, strategy. People who consistently win have a clear and thoughtful strategy for getting that which they envision. They have a map, a flowchart, and a timeline. They know what they need to do, when they need to do it, and the order in which it must take place. Very importantly, they write it down. You will see these people with calendars, flowcharts, folders, and other writings that visually anchor their strategy. Their strategy includes an assessment of their resources and appraisal of the obstacles they have to overcome. Number three, passion. People who consistently win play the game with passion. They get excited about what they are doing. They get energized about what they are doing. They become passionately invested in the journey as well as the goal and thrive on it all. For these people, the pursuit of their goal is not work. It is not tiring. The pursuit of their goal is fun and intriguing. These people are reluctant to go to bed at night, and they spring forth in the morning to get at what they seek. Their passion is contagious. Those around them begin to share in their excitement and purpose. Number four, truth. People who consistently win have no room in their lives for denial, fantasy, or fiction. These people tell it like it is, to themselves and others. They are self-critical rather than self-deluding and hold themselves to high but realistic standards. They are absolutely non-defensive when they get input and feedback, and they're able to find some value in any information. These are not people who were born on third base and think they hit a triple. They know who they are and what they are, and they build from that truth. They do not kid themselves about the scope or demands of their challenges. They deal with the truth, since they recognize that nothing else will make their vision attainable. Their attitude is, if I know where the bottom is, I can deal with it. If I don't, the problems cannot be planned for. Number five, flexibility. People who consistently win understand that life is not a success-only journey. They understand that even the best-laid plans sometimes must be altered and changed. These people do not remain rigidly fixed on any behavior or thought patterns. They are open to input and will consider any potentially viable alternative. If A works, they do A. If B works, they do B. They bend but never break. Because they measure themselves on results, not appearances, ego, or intentions, they are willing to be wrong and change or start over. Number six, risk. People who consistently win are willing to take risks. This does not mean they are reckless, and it does not mean that they put themselves or their goals in unnecessary danger. It seems that they are willing to get out of their comfort zone and try new things. It means that they are willing to plunge into the unknown if necessary and leave behind the safe, unchallenging, and familiar existence in order to have more. It means they are willing to admit that what they have is not enough, even though that very admission creates a pressure to change and the potential to fail. Number seven, nucleus. People who consistently win are not lone rangers. Winners recognize that they become such because they surround themselves with people who want them to win. They recognize that throughout life, you gather around you a nucleus of people with whom you healthfully interact. They choose and bond with people who have skills, talents, and abilities that they themselves may not have. These people with whom they surround themselves care enough to tell the truth and take pride in doing so constructively and helpfully. Building a nucleus of trusted friends and allies is critical, and winners do so by giving as well as receiving. They also become part of other people's nuclear groups. Number 8, action. People who consistently win take meaningful, purposeful, directional action. They are not people who redesign the world in their minds, but yet never pull the trigger. Because they are not afraid of risk, these people are willing to step up and do. They take action, and they do so consistently and persistently. They are undaunted if initial actions fail to yield results because they understand that the world does not give up its rewards easily. If it takes one effort, fine. If it takes 10, that's okay as well. Number 9, priorities. People who are consistent winners manage their challenges in hierarchical fashion. They set priorities and live those priorities. They commit to managing their time in such a way that they do not spend time grinding along on priority number 2 or 3 or 4 if priority number 1 needs their attention. If in the middle of the day they find themselves working on something other than their number 1 priority, they stop what they're doing and get back to number 1. They choose their priorities carefully because they organize their entire lives in accordance with them. Once again, they stay off of rabbit trails and they stay focused on what is most important before moving on to other things. Number 10, self-management. While all of the other 9 common denominators to success also involve self-management, this one is more specific. People who consistently win consciously and pointedly take care of themselves as individuals. They are the most important resource they have in achieving their goals. They actively manage their mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual health. They maintain a balance that keeps them safe from burnout. They do not become so consumed by their passion for a particular goal that they forget about the rest of their life. These 10 key elements, consistently found in the lives of people who are winners, are examples of the kinds of attributes that you may want to emulate in your own life. Make your own success study to validate the pivotal importance of these key elements. Whether it is a sports star or a youth director at your church, if that person is a winner, I guarantee you will see evidence of these elements in how they execute their life strategies. Please don't be intimidated by the lofty sound of any of these qualities. They are not restricted and are not accessible only to famous people. Those people are just like you and are in fact only famous because you made them that way. You will find these same key attributes present in school teachers and NBA stars alike. You will find them in nurses, clerks, and opera stars. You will find them in your very own home. I did. You see, I live with a world-class champion. Robin, my wife of 22 years, lives her life quietly, anonymously, but meaningfully, with the very same qualities and commitment of heart that you would expect to find in a Michael Jordan or a Cheryl Swoops. Robin is at least as good at what she does as they are at what they do. The only real difference is that a Michael Jordan creates his magic in full view of millions of spectators, while Robin creates her magic for a private audience consisting of me and our 2 boys. She has never been on television or played in a championship game, yet I have absolutely seen her perform acts of heroic proportions. You hear of a Jordan or Swoops reaching down and finding that strength in the 4th quarter? I have witnessed this woman reach down and find strength when it was not a game that would be over in a few minutes. I saw her depth as she nursed her father through months of a painful bout with cancer that culminated in his death. Yet she was still there every single day for our sons and me. I have seen her keep a bedside vigil lasting 90 hours straight when our firstborn developed life-threatening meningitis, never a word of complaint. She is a mother and a wife, and she fills those roles with passion and vision. Although she is only 5'2" tall and 115 pounds, mess with one of her children and you have a serious problem. She would fight a bear if he had a buzzsaw. There is no quit, there is no tired, there is no doubt. The lady is a winner, the lady is a champ. Nobody brings her a trophy or wants to interview her at the end of the day. But yet she plays her game with the same passion, vision, and action as anyone in any game, anywhere. While Michael and Cheryl are driving the lane, Robin is driving carpool. Just as Michael Jordan is the heart and soul of his team, Robin, as a loving mother and wife, is the heart and soul of her family. She lives with dignity and quality in good times and bad. She has a plan for our family. She has a vision for our boys. She takes care of herself so she can take care of us. She creates a warm, loving, and nurturing environment that can spawn nothing but success. Lest you think that there really aren't stories of daily greatness in a workaday world, and that I only attribute those things to Robin because I happen to have been living with her for the last 22 years, let me tell you about Andy. One of my dearest friends and closest associates, Bill Dawson, got me and my firm involved in a corporate firefight in California that was of staggering proportions. We were representing several Fortune 100 companies in a battle for over $1 billion in cash. The trial would last for almost 5 months, and hotel living for that long is a strain under the best of circumstances. Bill Dawson was lead counsel and is one of the finest lawyers in America. When he gets on a case, he is a junkyard dog and tirelessly outprepares the other side. That means meetings before trial, meetings during trial, and prep sessions for the next day that go into the wee hours of the morning. Transportation in this city was a nightmare. I met Andy my first night in town. He picked me up in his cab shortly after midnight to take me from the airport to my hotel. Now, I've been in a lot of cabs in a lot of cities. Some are clean, most are not, and they all smell bad. I knew this cab was different the minute I got in. Although it was after midnight, Andy had that cab sparkling. He had on a shirt and tie and was groomed to match his cab. On the back seat, neatly folded, were current copies of the local newspaper, USA Today, and the Wall Street Journal. They had probably been read 10 times that day, but every page was in place. There was not one doubt in my mind that Andy took pride in what he was doing and the way he was doing it. His grammar wasn't the best, and his shirt was pretty worn, but it was clean, and you could tell that he took pride in his appearance. Racing around town the next day, I was in 3 or 4 different cabs that made me want to shower with my clothes on the second I got out. I got my receipt from the previous day out and called Andy. I explained that I had 6 or 8 people on my team who would be moving around the city on a regular basis and going to and from the airport for the next several months. I asked Andy if he could handle our transportation needs while we were in town. Thankfully, he agreed. Over the next 4.5 months, I came to know a simple man with simple means at his disposal who had a vision for his life and a passion in his pursuit. Andy covered us like a blanket. He was there early, not some of the time, but all of the time. There were times when he picked up some of my team members at 6 in the morning and yet was at the airport getting me well after midnight that very same day. The cab was always clean. He was always clean. He was professional, and he was committed to doing his job. As time wore on, I rode with and talked to Andy. He shared with me his philosophy. If you do things right and you work hard, it will pay off. He explained that his goal was to have his own cab company in 5 years. He was excited about his goal, there was no doubt. One Friday night when he took me to the airport, there were substantial weather delays, and Andy asked if I would like to see his business plan while I waited. He was in no hurry because he would never leave until he was sure I had made my flight and did not need him further. I was absolutely blown away. Words were misspelled and it was handwritten, but it made sense. He had done the math. He had projected into the future. He had a timeline and he had clear outcome criteria. Andy was a man with a plan. He was also an integral part of the logistics supporting one of, if not the largest lawsuit to be tried in America that year. He moved me and my team, key witnesses and lawyers, in a timely, reliable, and professional fashion. You could tell he was proud to be part of it. He followed our progress each day in the paper and became pretty darn knowledgeable about the facts. On my last day there, Andy took me to the airport and asked if he could walk me to my gate. On the way, he said, "Doc, I just want to thank you for letting me be part of this deal and making me feel like I made a difference. I learned a lot, and if I never see you again, I want to thank you for giving me the chance and the business." Talk about a class act. I thanked Andy for his help and told him that I believed in him. I told him that his plan was good and that I had every confidence that it would work. He was truly a man of vision and a man of passion. Thank God that there are people in this world like Andy, doing jobs like Andy's, or those of us who get to think we're pretty big deals would be in a whole lot of trouble. As I sat on the plane going home, I thought more about Andy than I did our lawsuit. It was plain to me that Andy was at least as good at what he did as I was at what I did. Andy was a champion and a winner. He took pride in his station in life and bloomed where he was planted. People in Congress, corporate America, and a whole lot of other places could learn a lot from Andy. I know I did. Now, I could tell you scores of similar stories, but I'll bet you already get the message. No matter where you are, no matter what you're doing, no matter how far you went in school or didn't, by living the laws of life and folding the key elements of a winning formula into your own personality, you can be a winner too. The choice is yours.
Life Strategies, Doing What Works, Doing What Matters, was written and read by Philip McGraw, Ph.D. It was abridged for audio by John McElroy. The recording engineer was Chris Welton. Editing and post-production by Michael Jones. The associate producer was Sloan Seaman. The director was Linda Wolman. Life Strategies was produced by Karen Frillman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.